And now I'd like to introduce Mr. Joseph Corbett, Chief Financial Officer of the Postal Service, who will give an overview of the five-year financial plan. Also on the call is Lloyd Sprung, Senior Managing Director of Evercore, the Postal Service's financial advisor. And I'd like to ask everyone who's in the room just to put your BlackBerries on mute. Joe, go ahead.
Thanks, Susan, and good afternoon to everyone. Some of you may ask about the purpose of the plan. We've talked a lot publicly about pieces of our plan going forward, but at this point, we are communicating to make sure that all of our stakeholders have a common understanding of our five-year business plan, which has been updated through 2016. And obviously, the media are key stakeholders to us. At the same time, over the next day, we will be continuing to communicate this plan, both in written form and orally, to the administration, to the Hill, both chambers and the leaders on our committees, and to various parts of the administration, including OMB, the National Economic Council, Department of Treasury, the General Accountability Office, the Postal Regulatory Commission, and importantly, our customers, our employees, and our suppliers, to make sure that everyone understands our plan going forward and the importance of executing against that plan as soon as possible. Again, we've updated it through 2016, and the plan we sent out has additional detail not released before. The trends I'll mention have not changed substantially from the comprehensive plan we issued last year. However, the absolute numbers have changed, and I'll cover those in my presentation. The last thing I'd mention is that we've worked over the last couple of months with Evercore Partners, who we hired as our financial advisors, and we did that for a reason, obviously. It's critically important, given the multi-billion-dollar decisions we're making as an organization, that we reach proper and supported conclusions as to the best path forward. In the past, we've consulted a number of consulting firms, et cetera, and this year we had Evercore come in as the financial advisors to work with us and to help validate the plan itself. And so what you see here in front of you is a plan which has been through a significant level of due diligence, and it's what we believe, management believes, is the proper plan going forward. I will not touch upon each slide in the deck that was sent out, but I will refer to the number of the slide I'm talking about when I get to it so that you can all follow the presentation. I'll start on slide 2. And on this slide, it's simply the foundation for the plan. Being more efficient has been part of the Postal Service's DNA over the last decade, whereas other organizations within the federal government may not have the same metrics they're driven to as we do. We continue to be as efficient as possible. A couple of highlights, which I mentioned on my quarterly call, so for a few of you, this may be redundant, but I think it's very important to understand the platform from which we are springing to execute this plan. First of all, the Postal Service was just recently ranked in the last quarter by Oxford Strategic Consulting as the best postal service within the world's top 20 largest economies. The two principal drivers for that rating were efficiency and quality of service. I'd point out that the Postal Service was determined to be 200% more efficient than the nearest post. So the difference between 1 and 2 was a factor of 2. Also, I'd point out that over the last year and last quarter, we reached record levels of efficiency or total factor productivity as determined by outside consulting firms. Now, let's get to the meat of it and the picture of the Postal Service if we do not move quickly and execute this plan. On a status quo basis, the Postal Service would continue to lose money, and in fact, those losses would grow to over $21 billion in the year 2016 alone. Also, what's important to note from this schedule is that only 5.8, and I say only softly, but only 5.8 of that $21 billion loss relates to pre-funding of our retiree health benefit payments. We expect that with no action taken as covered in this plan, we would lose $15.5 billion on an operating loss. That's certainly unsustainable, and we need to fix not only our medical plan and not only our required and unique requirement to pre-fund RHB, but we need to also streamline the operations to adjust the overall network to the expected volume of mail going forward. On slide four, the reasons for needing to execute against this plan haven't changed since last time we talked, so I won't spend much time on this slide. Simply, volume, especially first-class mail volume, continues to decline steadily. Our costs are largely fixed. Over 80% of our costs are labor, and that cost has historically risen with the overall cost of employment or above the overall cost of employment in the general market. And our prices are capped. So with declining volumes and fixed costs and the inability to adjust our pricing, you can see that the losses will continue to mount until we successfully execute the plan. On the next page, just a couple of comments about first-class mail. First, it's not the economy any longer driving the majority of the decline in first-class mail. In fact, it's electronic diversion. This chart shows some simple examples in everyday life that all of us see every day. People are going online to paying their bills. People file tax returns. Over 50% of tax returns were filed electronically last year. 5 years ago, that number was closer to 10%. So you can see the acceleration of mail out of the mail stream and into the electronic communications. Turning to slide seven, I just want to point out one thing. The U.S. Postal Service is not in a unique situation here. First-class mail, or its equivalent, across the entire world is declining. There's virtually no post estimating first-class mail or its equivalent to grow over the next decade. In fact, in the U.K., recent reports projected that first-class mail may drop as much as 25% in the next 3 years. It's a fact, and it's a fact we all have to deal with. On slide eight, I want to really drill down into the underlying problem and into our products. First-class mail is declining and declining steadily, as I said before. In terms of volume, we expect first-class mail to decline from 2011 to 2016, at which point first-class mail will drop from almost 44% of our mail to about 37%. And in terms of revenue, the decline is even greater, with first-class mail declining from nearly 50% of our revenue to approximately 41% of our revenue. Now, that in and of itself is alarming, but then when you look at the next slide and you see that over two-thirds of our contribution comes from first-class mail, you can clearly see the underlying problem in terms of the mail stream. We have been successful growing the package business. We have been successful maintaining our market share in terms of standard mail and advertising mail, but it's first-class mail that has paid the bills for the Postal Service over the last decade, and it's by far the largest part of our business and most profitable part. So we will continue to execute on other parts of our business. However, we need to make other changes to the structure of the business, given the fact that first-class mail is declining so rapidly. On the next page, next slide, slide 10, you simply see a line chart. The brown line at the bottom to the right represents where we expect revenue to be in each of the years over the plan, the five-year plan period ended in 2016. Yet, without taking the actions outlined in this plan, the cost would grow to almost $75 billion, creating a huge gap between overall revenue and costs. Let me put a couple numbers against that plan and what we would expect in terms of our cash flows and our debt in 2016 on slide 11. On slide 11, you can see that our projected cash flow, if we don't take the actions in the plan, and again, I emphasize if, because obviously we plan to and we need the assistance of our stakeholders in achieving this plan. Our projected cash flow would otherwise be a negative $20.5 billion in the year 2016. More importantly, perhaps, and shockingly, our debt would grow to a level of over $92 billion in 2016, clearly an amount the Postal Service cannot afford. And clearly, this is a situation which is unavoidable if we execute the plan. We do not want to become a burden to the U.S. taxpayers. We want to operate against the plan and execute it fully so that we return to profitability, and I'll describe to you how that will occur as we go through the rest of this presentation. On slide 12, it simply points out what we've been communicating over and over again. 80% of our overall costs relate to personnel, salaries and benefits, and over 38% of personnel costs are tied to federal programs and are outside of our control. The USPS cannot change those programs. You'll see that one principal element of our plan is that we take over our health care, and I'll comment on that later. Ultimately, down the line, perhaps other benefit problems will programs will follow. Turning to slide 14, you see both a table on the left and a graphical representation on the right. I'd like to point out the key elements to our plan. These are the changes that need to be made in order to return the Postal Service to profitability and to financial stability. First, we need to resolve RHB pre-funding, and we plan to do that through taking over the medical program and having that administered and run by the Postal Service as opposed to participating in the federal employment health plans. Second, as we've said before, we need to move from 6 to 5 day delivery. As I mentioned before, our costs are largely fixed. As a result, if you're required to deliver to 150 million addresses 6 days a week, there is a fixed cost to doing that. 5 days a week clearly cuts out some of that fixed cost. Other operational initiatives we've talked about before are now quantified in terms of 2016 savings. The numbers on the chart also represent the additional efficiencies we need to gain by right-sizing our staff against the actual expected volumes in each of the years. In total, between the network, sortation and transportation, retail and delivery, we expect to be able to save in the year 2016 $9 billion. Other savings need to come from compensation benefits and non-personnel costs of over $5 billion, representing a total potential savings if we flawlessly execute this plan of $22.5 billion. And again, I emphasize, that is an annual number. That is the amount of expense we need to reduce in 2016 and continuing on throughout the next decade. A couple comments on the medical plan, because I think it's critically important to understand this. First, I want to talk about the company perspective, and second, and most importantly, I want to talk about the changes that we are proposing and the impact it would have on our employees. From a company perspective, in the current system, if we were to remain in the current FEHB, we would expect, again on slide 15, would expect the total cost of our health care to be $13.2 billion, an astounding number given a $70 billion total cost structure. Under a new USPS plan, which has been recommended and reported on by our consultants, both Aon and the Hay Group, we would expect in 2013 the annual cost of our plan to be $6.2 billion, or a $7 billion savings in 2013 alone. We also expect that that savings would grow as we and have modeled that throughout this plan ending in 2016. The savings in this plan come from two main elements. First, requiring our retirees to participate in Medicare where some do not currently participate. Every self-funded program outside the federal government has this requirement, and we should too. Second, by taking over our own plan and limiting the overall number of insurers bidding to be in our plan to a number which is less than 10% of what the federal employee plan allows, will allow us to execute and use our leverage in the market to bring down the cost of overall health insurance. Now, turning to the employee side, our efforts are designed to reduce the overall cost of health care. Our retirees currently pay 30% of that cost, and the Postal Service funds 70% of that cost for people in retirement, consistent with other federal programs. So for every dollar we save, our employees will save 30 cents or 30% of that savings. So we expect that the vast majority of our employees will pay a lower cost for the same or better coverage in a new program, and that we will save, and so will the employees. This is not, I repeat, this is not a program which takes benefits away. On page 16, it focuses on the next most significant area in terms of saving costs. And again, this is the change we plan to make in terms of overall service standards and delivery of mail, which is contingent upon issuance of new service standards by the Postal Service. We expect that through reconfiguration and consolidation of our area mail processing plants, that we could achieve an annual savings of $2.5 billion in cost by 2015, and that number will continue to grow over what would be anticipated in later years by making these changes. How do we achieve these costs? Slide 17 shows you the reduction in full-time equivalent positions the Postal Service would need to execute in order to achieve the savings you see in this plan. In short, we need a reduction of 155,000 employees by 2016 in connection with the strategic initiatives. One might view this as a very large number, but I have to add the following. Currently, and over the last 5 years, the average attrition is approximately 30,000 employees per year. This is the reduction over 5 years, so 155 is actually, over the five-year period, somewhere near the average that we have achieved over the previous 5 years. However, what we need to do in order to ensure the Postal Service's liquidity and a quick return to financial stability is to accelerate that attrition into the first 2 years of the plan. I wanted to point out also that we plan and believe that we will be able to get the majority of the workload reductions accomplished through attrition. The Postal Service has never had significant layoffs, and layoffs are not a part of our plan going forward. We believe we can achieve this through other means. And slide 18 is helpful in explaining these other means. The chart is a bit complicated, but essentially, the bullets on the far right-hand side of the bracket on this chart tell the story. Half of career employees are retirement eligible. 283,000 total employees today are either optionally eligible for retirement, which means they are fully eligible, or would be eligible in the context of a voluntary early retirement plan. And if you look at the FERS population, the optional employees in FERS have an average age of 64 years old. They're nearing the point in their careers where they are anticipating retirement, so we expect that we will be able to match the needed reductions with the reductions that actually will occur, perhaps with some incentive, which is still under consideration but certainly not concluded. So after executing all the initiatives that I referred to before, slide 19 shows you a picture of a healthy Postal Service, one that's generating a small profit in 2016, $1.2 billion on over $60 billion of revenue, but nonetheless a profit, an operating profit, with positive cash flows of almost $2 billion, and with a balance sheet that now is strong. We would be able to eliminate our debt and accumulate approximately $7 billion of cash. This accumulation of cash also happens to coincide with the period over which we will need to replace our delivery vehicles. We have over 200,000 delivery vehicles on the street today. The average age in 2016 of those delivery vehicles will be approximately 27 years old. They need to be replaced, and the total replacement cost, coincidentally, could be as high as $7 billion. So we'll have a need for that cash, and we need to accumulate cash as a cushion going forward also. Slide 20 is a very detailed income statement for your analysis. I will not comment on it beyond the two circled amounts. Again, without executing this plan and on a status quo basis, we would lose over $21 billion in 2016. We know we can't afford to have this occur, and our stakeholders know we can't afford to have this occur. After executing all the elements of this plan, and I emphasize all, as a package, we would return to an organization which is marginally profitable and positioned from a balance sheet perspective to be financially solid and to be able to keep serving the American public and our customers well into the future. Slide 21 is simply the roll forward of our cash balances using the income statement I just referred to. Again, the number to emphasize here is that without these actions, we would be $92 billion in debt and a burden to the American taxpayers. We do not want to become that. It's fully avoidable if we execute the plan that we can return to financial stability on our own. We're not just talking about cost cutting. We've introduced a number of various products over the last 3 years, and we'll continue to work on the top line. As I mentioned just days ago in my quarterly news conference, our package business is growing and growing well. Packages grew almost 9% in volume last quarter, and there's plenty of opportunity for packages to continue to grow in the future. 9%, I'll add, in a competitive area was double the most recent quarterly growth that was released by UPS and by FedEx. So we're competing well in the areas where we compete. In terms of new products for mailing, just a couple that I would mention, Every Door Direct Mail in our standard advertising mail category. That's a product that has been introduced just this past year and has the potential to be a $1 billion a year revenue product. It is growing rapidly, and we're focused on it. In terms of first-class mail, as I said before, first-class mail is going to continue its decline. But our strategy, obviously, is to provide excellent client service and customer service and retain as much of that mail as possible and grow it where possible. We recently announced our Reply Rides Free, where we were able to process and deliver envelopes up to 2 ounces for the price of one, and we believe this will help retain some of the mail in that category. The real darling has been the shipping side of the business, as I mentioned before. Our returns are growing. Our last mile delivery is growing, where others drop off packages and we deliver for them, the last mile. And the advertising that we've been doing around packages, et cetera, is growing that product very well. Again, unfortunately, packages only represent about 15% of our overall revenue. So we'll continue to do a good job in the shipping business, but it won't be enough without the other initiatives to return us to profitability. Page 23 shows some of the products and the revenue potential. I think I mentioned those in my comments, and I won't expand on those any longer. On page 24, every business plan has risks. These are projections. And admittedly, the actual results don't always mirror projections. But a couple of things I want to point out about the business plan. Again, redundant to my prior comments, but critically important. What we've laid out here, as you can see from the math, is not a menu of options from which we can select. In fact, we need the whole menu to be accomplished in order to return the Postal Service to where it needs to be in terms of being in a healthy environment and being able to continue to be the anchor, or that's probably the improper term, to be the center around which $1 trillion or almost 7% of GDP revolves. Half of the initiatives that are in this plan can be, as a legal matter, achieved without congressional or legislative change. Again, half could be, as long as there's no, with the laws on the books today, and as long as there's no hurdles or roadblocks put in the way as we move forward. The other half of the nearly $20 billion of savings that we need to achieve by 2015 and $22 billion by 2016, the other half requires significant legislative change, and we continue to communicate that to our stakeholders on the Hill and in the administration. Both the Senate, the House, and the administration have put forth proposals that are very helpful, and we're very appreciative for everything they're doing and for the attention they're giving to the Postal Service, the attention it deserves and the attention that they are giving every day. Unfortunately, not one of the proposals incorporates all the changes that we have in our business plan in order to return to financial stability. Last, I'll just turn your attention to a couple of the slides in the back, which are essentially different scenarios. As I said, admittedly, these are projections. And with projections, actual may differ. So what we've laid out in the appendix to the plan are scenario comparisons that simply say, okay, what happens if there's a forecasting error of $3 billion, plus or minus, up or down, and what would the impact to the overall plan be on revised net income and on cash flows? And the answer, largely speaking, is that even a significant difference between actual results and forecasted results will still underscore the need for change. Instead of incurring a loss in 2016 on a status quo basis of over $20 billion, that range could be between $15 and $25 billion on the extremes. Nonetheless, either of those numbers is huge and is entirely unavoidable, or rather entirely avoidable, so long as we execute the plan as we've laid out. Key takeaways from the overall presentation, obviously first-class mail is primarily the culprit. It's a fact. It's a worldwide fact, and it's going to continue to decline. If we don't execute the plan, we would be $90 billion plus in debt at the end of 2016, which clearly is not a position that we can be in. Flawless execution of the plan and support by our stakeholders is required in order to return us to a position where we'll once again be the institution that can be relied upon day in and day out, just as we are today, to for quality service and for reliability and to keep the economy moving. Thanks, Susan. That's will conclude my remarks.
Okay, we're now going to open up the call for the Q&A portion of our presentation. I wanted to remind you to please press #71 on your telephone keypad when you have a question. Remember to announce your name and the name of your organization before asking questions. And also, please direct the questions to Mr. Corbett.
Now joining the floor,
Angela Greiling-Keen. Hi, Joe. Angela Greiling-Keen with Bloomberg. As you know, I've covered you guys for a while and looked through the plan. I don't see a whole lot of new things in here, basically asking Congress and the regulator and so forth to do things you've asked them to do and laying out why. Should we have expected to see some new things after the consultation with Evercore?
Thanks, Angela. My expectation at the point where we engaged Evercore, quite frankly, having done a ton of internal due diligence and having talked with all our stakeholders, customers, members of Congress, et cetera, as to their ideas and evaluated those ideas as we put the plan together and before Evercore was on board, quite frankly, my expectation was that we would have caught pretty much all the major material items. But because of the importance of this plan and the multi-billion-dollar decisions we're making, we thought it was imperative that we have a fresh look. We brought Evercore on board. There are some changes they have recommended and we adopted. But I would say that there are no material changes in terms of the direction of where the business is going or the things that we believe are achievable going forward in terms of the operations of the overall organization. So I was hoping for new items. I really was, and so was the entire management team. But nonetheless, the plan looks very similar. I think the main difference you will see between this and the last comprehensive plan we issued is actually the numbers in a status quo basis have worsened. The decline in first-class mail is higher over the last 18 months than what we anticipated to be in our March 2nd plan of last year. So things have not gotten any easier, but the requirement to execute the items on here cannot be any more important than it is today.
Thank you. And then is Evercore's work done, or are they continuing to do more work for you guys?
Well, they spent the last couple of months doing their due diligence on our plan, and we will continue to work with Evercore in a number of areas in terms of the communication of the plan, in terms of potential witnesses in various venues that may come up to in support of the plan. Et cetera. But in terms of this particular plan, the work in terms of the due diligence has been completed.
Okay. Thank you.
Now leaving the floor.
Angela Greiling-Keen.
Now joining the floor.
Sean Riley. Mr. Corbett, Sean Riley, Federal Times. Two questions regarding the workforce plan, workforce reductions. One, could you elaborate a little more on where you are in consideration of offering a voluntary early retirement and when you expect to make a decision and if you go forward, then how would be financed? And also, I'm looking at the chart on page 17. It shows that you're looking at a reduction of 66,000 apparently in FY11, of course, which has already passed. I mean, have those reductions occurred?
Sean, let me take your last question first. What slide were you referring to?
This is slide, the one numbered 17, initiatives will reduce workload and staffing needs. It shows the workforce going from 557,000, I think, career FTE down to 491, but it appears to be occurring in FY11 or calendar 11, one or the other, I don't know.
Yeah. No, that's these are actually represent fiscal years, and that occurs between in fiscal year 12. The bar represents the end of the fiscal year.
Okay. So you're looking at this. So this would occur. The 66,000 you're looking at is occurring in FY12.
Right. Correct.
Okay.
And turning to your first question, Sean, the first answer is no, I can't elaborate. So the second answer would be no, I can't elaborate to the timing. But the third question I certainly can address, and that is the financing of any incentives should they be should a program be rolled out. And the answer is we will have to structure this in a way that our cash savings is achieved before we actually pay out the incentive.
Mm-hmm.
So in other words, if we were to accelerate on average a person's retirement by 1 year and we were to pay a third of that person's salary, then we'd have to wait 4 months to accumulate that savings from them not being on the payroll before we could pay them their incentive. So we would defer the incentive payments but guarantee those.
Mm-hmm.
That's the way we'd have to structure the cash flows in order to not, in fact, accrue the benefit as opposed to cause additional cash pressure.
And one follow-up on that then, as you know, the Senate bill S-1789 proposes, I believe, giving the Postal Service a credit on its FERS surplus and using at least some of that money to fund either early retirement or early out. Is that an option you're considering as well? Although obviously it depends on congressional action.
Yes, that's you. I think you might have partially answered your own question. It does rely on that. Whereas, if we were to provide an incentive going forward, we could accomplish that within our own cash flows. However, a driving need for 1789 would be to have the cash readily available. We believe we could have more people adopt a program if we were to roll it out, if they were paid immediately rather than deferring their payment, although the amounts may not be materially different in terms of the number of people who elect to retire.
Thank you.
Now leaving the floor.
Sean Riley.
And we'd like to remind everyone that if you have a question, to please press #71 on your telephone keypad, and please announce your name and organization. Thank you.
Now joining the floor.
Eric Morath, Dow Jones. Hi, Joe. Thanks for this. Wanted to ask you about slide 13 in the revenue section, asking for a legislative change to allow increase to a 50-cent first-class stamp. Wanted to know, was that a proposal to go from 45 today to 50 cents, you know, pending congressional approval, or would that be a 1 cent a year rollout, say? And secondly, when was the last time, if ever, the Postal Service raised the first-class stamp by that amount?
Yeah, I'm glad you asked that question, because this bullet is by way of example.
Okay.
In terms of round numbers, so 45, which it is today, would go to 50, mm-hmm. and that would be a round number of $1 billion. That's not a one-year proposal we have right now, but it's an example of what we would do if we had the legislative authority to do that.
Mm-hmm.
We haven't yet made any decision as to whether that would be done in 1 year or multiple years,
mm-hmm.
But it was by way of example something we need. The U.S. today is by far the least expensive post in the world, and in some cases by a factor of two or three over other developed countries, not other developing countries. So clearly we're underpriced in that area for single class first piece, and so we would like the ability to be able to move that cost up, or rather that price up.
And is the 50 cents sort of a cap that you're proposing, or are you just saying you basically want to eliminate the tying it to inflation?
We would like to eliminate it to inflation, but we believe that the regulators would want some cap. So in other words, the 5 cent additional room to raise pricing in the future would be granted in addition to future increases in the cost related to overall cost increases in the economy, i.e. CPI. But that 5 cents, what I was pointing out was we've made no decision that would be done in 1 year. That may be done over a multi-year period. but ultimately would result in $1 billion of incremental contribution.
And that's $1 billion per year or no?
Correct. Yes.
Okay, so once you got to 5 cents, whether it's a next year or 5 years, at that point it'd be $1 billion plus on the positive side for you.
Correct.
Okay. Thank you for explaining.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Now leaving the floor.
Eric Morath, Dow Jones.
Now joining the floor.
Sean Riley. Sean Riley again. One other question regarding the projected workload reductions. You're looking, as I read this chart, you want to cut the total FTE, career FTE, by 117,000 in FY12 and FY13 with or without a VER. Am I reading that right? Again, this is slide 17.
That's correct. That's the target reduction.
Okay, and is there any way you can do that without a VER? If you're going to do it by attrition?
That's why I couldn't answer your question earlier about whether we've reached a conclusion. We continue to study it. With 283,000 people eligible for retirement today, it's possible. But nonetheless, we continue to look at it, and we'll announce our path forward shortly.
And one other question regarding the projected debt. I just want to make sure I understand this right. When you're talking about something like $92 billion in debt when you count the accumulated RHP and debt to the Treasury, $92.1 billion by 2016. Yeah, of course, as you indicate there, the post office is legally limited to borrowing $15 billion from the Treasury. Are you presuming that Congress would agree to raise that cap as needed?
Not at all. Our expectation and our plan is that Congress won't need to do that because we'll be able to implement substantially all the elements of the plan to make sure that doesn't occur. So that's a hypothetical. I don't think that any of our stakeholders would allow the Postal Service to get to a situation where we would be $92 billion in debt. However, that's where the numbers will turn out if we don't execute the plan.
And I've also heard that, I read that the PMG announced at MTAC yesterday that the Postal Service plans to begin a major communications plan shortly. Can you elaborate on exactly what you will be doing that you're not doing now?
Yeah, basically the communications, one major element of that communications plan is to make sure that all of our stakeholders have this plan and understand this plan. As well as we do internally, if that's possible. And we're not naive. We know that some stakeholders will have positions which don't agree with everything that's in the plan, but we believe that everybody needs the same foundation from which the discussions can spring. In addition to that, we'll be talking about how we plan to implement the plan and various elements of the plan going forward in the near term over the next couple of weeks.
And do you think are you essentially trying to reboot your efforts here? Because, as you know, I mean, there doesn't seem to be any immediate prospect of passage of either the House or Senate bills or the administration's package anytime soon in Congress. Are you hoping to accelerate that process or give this fresh urgency?
We certainly are. And we've been doing all in our power, but basically the refresh of the plan and bringing it out to the year 2016 is something we would do on an annual basis anyway. So this just happens to coincide with our planning cycle, but we hope it has the effect of galvanizing our stakeholders to a point where the common information will allow us to reach quicker decisions and we can move forward on the plan in a more efficient manner.
Yeah. And one final question regarding the proposal for a separate health plan. You know, the Postal Service first indicated it wanted to do this back last August. And since then, as far as I know, hasn't provided appreciably more information about exactly what this plan would look like, what the benefit levels would be, what the cost would be to employees. Do you intend to do that anytime soon to allay concerns that, in fact, this would be a worse deal for employees and retirees than they currently get under the FEHBP?
Yes, we do, and plan to do that in a formal communication. We have met with various leaders of our employee groups, both the unions and the management associations, mm-hmm. to explain this. We realized that it's important to have a formal document and communication of that out to the greater masses. So, yes, we are working on that.
Can you, and how soon?
I'm afraid I can't answer that right now, but I can tell you that it's very high on our priority list.
Okay. Thank you again.
I believe that once people see the plan and understand the plan, that there will be general and perhaps even massive support for the plan, because it puts money in employees' pockets. It does not take money out, nor does it take benefits out, and we'll demonstrate that when we roll out the communication.
Okay. Thank you.
Now leaving the floor.
Sean Riley.
Now joining the floor.
Eric Morath, Dow Jones. I think you largely answered the question I had on the debt ceiling. That it's clear at this point that $90 billion is kind of hypothetical, but it just sort of bring up the point of, I want to be clear on, you know, if the debt ceiling is reached, and I think we talked about this last time, the Postal Service would have to start making choices regarding payments and things like that, and because they wouldn't be able to borrow any longer. Is that correct?
That is correct. If we got the $15 billion, the Federal Finance Bank, which is our lender, would not be allowed to loan us any other money. One thing I want to point out very clearly, because I think in certain areas of the press after my quarterly call, it was misrepresented. Our priority in terms of the Postal Service is to move the mail and move the mail in a quality manner, and we expect over the next 2 years to have sufficient liquidity to do that. What we are, in terms of our priority of payment, in order to do that, our priority payments will be made to employees and to suppliers and all those who are central to quality delivery of the mail and, most importantly, also not most importantly, but also our package business. There are certain multi-billion-dollar payments due to the federal government. And we expect to make those also if we're allowed to execute this plan. If we're forced to a position where we need to choose between delivering the mail, which we believe and our board believes is the number one fiduciary responsibility of this organization, or making other contractual or legally obligated payments, we could be forced to a position where we'd have to default on those payments. We don't think that's going to happen. But just to let you know, in terms of the priority of the overall Postal Service.
Okay. And then just back to my stamp price question. As you pointed out, it could be something that's imposed over a number of years. Is it fair to say that the Postal Service has never at one time raised the first class stamp by 5 cents? I think the largest I'm looking back. I think the largest I'm seeing it is 4. I don't know if you know that off the top of your head.
I don't, but we can get back to you on that outside of this call.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Now leading the floor.
Eric Morath, Dow Jones.
And there are currently no further questions in queue at this time.
If there's no further questions, we'll be closing the period of the presentation.
Hello?
And
hello?
Two more questions have just come in.
Very good.
Now joining the floor.
Sean Riley. Hi again. Not going to pass up this opportunity. One last thing. Back when you announced, you released the white papers in August, the Postal Service said it also wanted essentially the ability to abrogate labor contracts and get the freedom to lay off employees, and also create its own pension program. Have you dropped those ideas for the time being or permanently?
Given the first, in terms of addressing layoffs, given the plan and the elements of the plan and the ability to, as I said before, this plan does not anticipate the need to lay off employees. And we have just finished the update through 2016. So our conclusion at this point is that we can achieve the plan without layoffs. So, no, we don't have any current intentions to pursue layoffs.
Mm-hmm.
And And your second question, I'm sorry.
Does the Postal Service still want to create its own, create its own pension program or retirement program, at least for new employees?
I believe we will go in the future. However, mm-hmm. we have temporarily taken it off the table. There's just mm-hmm. too much to digest. Mm-hmm. The medical plan alone, we're convinced, will save $7 billion a year.
Mm-hmm.
There is substantially lower savings that could be achieved by taking over our retirement plans.
Mm-hmm.
And so they have become lower priorities given everything else we're trying to execute here. But they're mm-hmm. temporarily off the table, but I would expect that at some point in the future we'll be looking at potentially taking those over also.
Okay. Thank you again.
Now leaving the floor.
Sean Riley.
Now joining the floor.
Actually, Joe, this is Lloyd Sprung. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can, Lloyd.
Okay. I don't have a question, but I would like to make a statement as there's been some discussion on Evercore's role earlier with some questions, and I apologize I could not respond earlier given some technical difficulties. Evercore has taken an active role in analyzing UPS's models and assumptions and validating the approach taken by management to develop the plan. In the context of the tremendous operating challenges facing the USPS, we believe the plan is comprehensive and balanced through an equitable sharing of restructuring costs amongst both the employees, customers, and the shared sacrifice of the American public. And Joe took you through that, I think, in detail this afternoon. Importantly, we believe the plan allows the USPS to preserve its mission while also becoming economically self-sustaining, including full repayment of debt owed to the U.S. government and adequate liquidity to fund its operations going forward. At Evercore, we are honored to be working with the USPS and its excellent management team, and we look forward to continuing to provide strategic and financial advice to the USPS toward the successful implementation of the plan that you just heard Joe outline today. Thank you.
Thank you, Lloyd.
Now leaving the floor.
And once again, there are no further questions in queue.
Okay. That will end the Q&A portion of today's presentation. A press release and a copy of the presentation will be posted following later on this evening, a copy of this presentation. And if you have any further follow-up questions, please send them to myself or to Dave Partenheimer or to our media hotline, which you all have the email for. Thank you.